Hello and welcome to Florida Basketball Hour. I am Neil Blackman, Saturday Down South. On this episode, we're going to break down the NCAA tournament game from last week. We'll talk about Florida's final game of the season, the 102-100 heartbreaking loss to Colorado, who ultimately ended up losing to Marquette. The Gators lose to a team that's bounced the next round in a very close game. I'm sure that we will discuss officiating. I think we're also going to get into some Riley Kugel. We will talk a little bit, kind of an overview of the portal. This is a crazy, crazy time with the transfer portal opening before the NCAA tournament is even over. I wonder if that's something that, like, the NCAA seems to me to always pick bad fights, right? Like the NCAA lately with the prop bet fight, they're like, this encourages gambling. It's like, well, there's not really much evidence to demonstrate that it encourages gambling. A prop bet ban seems to me to be another situation where the NCAA is grasping for something that it really shouldn't have any control over, or that its control over is not necessarily a good thing. Whereas I do feel like, you know, the transfer portal and when it opens is something that the NCAA should probably, you know, I wouldn't see any issue with kind of altering that. But I think we first need to get into Florida, Colorado. So I do want to talk a little bit about it. I know it's been a few days, and that truly is on me. I had a child with a softball injury. I only laugh because, like, she never gets hurt in any other capacity and, like, never misses school ever. And, like, manages to break both arms playing softball. So shout out to her, I guess. And then just kind of mystifying as to how, like, this happens. And then I had more commercial airline kerfuffles. So the glamour of commercial airline travel. But I do have Eric Fawcett with me, who seems to be rocking a pretty sick little North Face. And I know he's ready to talk Florida, Colorado. And to me, like, the story of the game that hasn't been beaten to death on Twitter is that Florida went 11 minutes and 18 possessions without getting a stop in the second half.
Yeah, that's like, really, it just seems, I was going to say every time Florida makes the NCAA tournament, but that has not been a lot in our run of the show, but it's just like, whatever you do well is spotlighted, and whatever you do poorly gets spotlighted. And you see that all across the country. We've really seen it with Florida's NCAA tournament berths, even though there hasn't been many over the course of the show. It's just like, whatever you do well gets spotlighted, whatever you struggle at gets spotlighted. And the Gators, who really struggled to get stops all year long, went through one of their worst defense, like, even in what was a bad defensive year, arguably their worst defensive stretch, like you said, of whatever that crazy number was of 11 plus minutes. So I thought that was kind of the perfect microcosm of the season. And then again, something that I said a number of times on the podcast throughout the year, and I thought kind of really bore out, there was a lot of people who love this team. They get, they see a big point total on the board and they say, like, oh my God, what a great team. Look, they can score 90 and 100. So Florida must be good. And they probably were good, but all year long, even when they were becoming people's trendy Final Four picks, it was always like, hey, there's not a single metric that points to this team being any better than, like, the roughly 25th best team in the country. KenPom would be the perfect example. I think Colorado was 24th and Florida was 29th going into that game. The 24th best team edged out the 29th best team on a neutral floor, which is exactly what you would expect to happen. And all year long, when people were, you know, getting really high on the Gators because they have an explosive offense and sometimes they get 20 offensive rebounds, which really overwhelms opponents. And some people said, oh, this is a Final Four team. It was always like, well, they haven't really beaten anyone. And when they do beat good teams, it's usually because there's other factors at hand. And this has been an all-time KenPom / predictive metrics flexing year. And we'll get into that. But I think that Florida showed exactly what they were, that they were the 29th best team in the country. Like I don't think that that's, like, you know, again, people can say that's negative, but literally everything they did all season long pointed to them being between the 26th and 30th best team in the country. No matter what happened, even when they were losing games that they shouldn't have, when they were winning games that had people saying a Final Four team, they were never as bad as people thought. They were never as good as people thought. They were they were 25th to 30th best team in the country. They showed it all year long at every single turn, and they showed it in the NCAA tournament, which is like, no one should have been necessarily surprised. Like, that's kind of my like grandstand, not even getting into, like you said, the defense, which is probably a better thing to talk about. But like this team, that's kind of my thing, is just like, this team showed us exactly what they were since November. And then they did everything possible to show us exactly who they were. And then it culminated in a game where they said, this is exactly who we are. So that's kind of my take. That's my grand takeaway.
Yeah, I like it. I'll do a grand takeaway first too, then. I want to talk about the end of the game a little bit, because I think, well, I thought it was the best game in the first round. I will say that. And I say that both because I think for large segments, the game was very well played, despite, you know, Florida was very bad on defense. And then Colorado was, you know, if we had a Colorado basketball hour, we'd be talking about how, like, it's just astonishing that they couldn't handle a press against a team that doesn't press for like 5 minutes. I mean, we'd just be like, oh, well, this is a product of building a roster where you only have one ball handler, because it was so obvious that that was what was happening. And so when Florida finally denied KJ Simpson, you know, things kind of, the wheels came off. We don't do Colorado basketball hour. We do Florida basketball hour. So like my kind of grandstand view of it is that, one, Eric's exactly right. That this was a good team. It wasn't much more than that. That's why I call this episode The Blueprint, because I think like there are some blueprint things that you want to do. You want to be smart in the portal. I think they were for the most part this year. But it wasn't a great team, and that kind of bore itself out in games. I mean, they had one particular team that they matched up very well with, Alabama. So they got two nice wins over Alabama, almost got a third, but couldn't hang on to a lead on the road. And then otherwise, like when Florida played teams that were really, really good, they lost. And when they played teams that they should beat, they won, with the exception of Vanderbilt. And so they were a good team. They were limited by their inability to guard, which is why they got eliminated in the first round of the NCAA tournament. And then I tweeted it out, and actually, well, we can talk about Teddy Dupe, but while Teddy Dupe disagrees with me, I did see that, you know, like Scotty Wilbekin and Will You Get retweet and quote and say like, yep, absolutely. And their point was like, process wise, like there are some positives, Thomas Hauck, Alex Condon, and how good those evaluations were. Some of Florida's other portal evaluations. Now you have to asterisk like good evaluations, because with Poland leaving and Samuel leaving, like you have to be really good at it again, or you've got a problem. And I did kind of point that out as well, but like to clarify that on the show. So I think there were some blueprint process things that are very, very positive. There are also a couple things that I think we've always been pretty objective on Florida Basketball Hour. It's one of the nicest compliments that Eric and I get, is that you guys are fair. And like, they didn't guard well this year, a year after guarding pretty well. I think they're very vanilla schematically on defense. I don't think that they're multiple. I don't think that they tried different things enough to try to get more out of themselves defensively. And then I still think they could struggle at times in the half court, despite that really bulky efficiency number. Now I know I do think they were a good offense, because if you finish 12th in KenPom offensive efficiency, you're pretty good. But I think from a half court stuff standpoint, there are still some problems and some things to work out, and it's not going to get any easier when you lose a Zion Poland, who just finished with the best, what, assist to turnover ratio in program history. And if you don't like that stat, his offensive rating was the second highest for a Florida point guard in the last 20 years, behind Scotty Wilbekits himself. So it's going to be harder without those isolation guys who can kind of attack and get their own score off the dribble. Like, Florida's going to have to find those guys in the portal, which gets back to my point about portal evaluations being right. But if you want like grand picture, what did that all get you? It got you sixth place in the SEC and a first round exit. So, you know, where do I rank this season among the last handful? Well, I think it's been Florida's most exciting team in a while, but it wasn't as good as Mike White's second year. It wasn't as good as Mike White's third year. It ended maybe a round, maybe even two rounds before the COVID team would have ended, depending on what would have happened with them in the NCAA tournament. I think that was a team that could have gotten to the Sweet 16 with favorable matchups. Also could have been beaten in round one with an unfavorable matchup. Like, who knows? We'll never know what would have happened because of COVID. So, like, the point being, I think there's three Mike White teams you could argue were better than this one. So, like, I don't think we need to be jumping up and down and saying that Florida's figured everything out. They haven't. But this was better.
Let me just reframe a question for you quickly, and then we will first of all, so if we're going to go by Ken Pom, yeah, Florida had a fifth-ranked Ken Pom team, 22nd, 26th, and 32nd. And then, you know, you could even argue, like, they had the 41st, where they, like, they were kind of the fraudulent team that had the 7 seed, despite being 41st in Ken Pom. They were kind of the team that, like, played above their skis. But, like, let me reframe the question for you. How about zero tournament wins in 2 years? Extrapolating the sample size a little bit to 2 years, Florida has zero NCAA tournament wins in the first 2 years of Todd Golden. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think at Florida, that's something that concerns me a little bit. Even allowing for the fact that you know, everybody likes to make the argument that Mike White inherited a bunch of players from Billy Donovan, and so that's why they went 28-7 or whatever in his second year. I think it was 27-9. In his second year and finished third in the SEC and went to the Elite Eight. But like, Chris Chiota wasn't a productive freshman. Casey Hill improved under White. And he did have Devin Robinson, who hardly played. They also lost their top three scorers. So like, I don't need to relitigate all that to say that, you know, you can believe that or not believe that, but you know, if you're going to make that argument, okay. So Golden managed to convince Colin Castleton to stay. But with Colin Castleton and Alex Fudge, who have been on NBA rosters this season, Florida didn't win a game in the NCAA tournament. In fact, finished 16-17 in his first year. And then in year two, I think they were much better. Like I said, I think this is a good season. They went 24-12. They were exciting. They were fun. They also lost in the first round of the NCAA tournament. So I think year three becomes pretty important, even if you're ahead from a process standpoint. That would be my answer to the question.
So I just wanted to mention this as well. And I guess this will be, I don't know if you want to interpret this as somewhat of a defense of KenPom / advanced analytics, or just again, like people who constantly push back when we were like, yeah, this kind of looks like it's a team that's like maybe an 8 seed and the 30th best team in the country. So I'm going to read off to you and listen to this very carefully, the KenPom rankings of the teams that remain in the Sweet 16. So this is, yes, this is where every team that is currently in the Sweet 16 sits in KenPom. So listen to this carefully. First, second, third, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 17th, 23, and the outlier NC State at 54. So 13 of the top 14 teams in KenPom are currently in the Sweet 16. So when we say, oh, like, look, like, no matter what Florida does and they get these wins and they win 5 games in a row and they improve from like 30th to 28th in KenPom, and people are like, look, they're heating up. Like, look, this could be a Final Four team. Like, maybe look at the bigger sample. And I'd also say then another thing that's quite funny to me is like, people always say, oh, preseason rankings, they don't matter. Like, they're trash. And like, yeah, you know, I understand what they're saying. Like, I if you look at KenPom's preseason rankings, it's like 10 of the top 12 teams are still in the Sweet 16. So he did pretty well. And even the AP poll, which is notoriously, you know, thought to be horrendous, and oh, these polls are stupid and these guys don't know what they're talking about, Like, yeah, like largely that is the case, but this was the preseason. This is a preseason poll from KenPom this year. From the AP poll. Kansas was number one. Ugh. They had a lot of injury problems. Duke, Purdue, Michigan State, Marquette, Connecticut, Houston, Creighton, Tennessee, Florida Atlantic, Gonzaga, Arizona. That's up to 12. So like even the preseason poll had like seven of the top, the AP poll that everyone is like, these guys are clowns. They don't know what they're talking about. I don't know. 7 to 10 of them are still playing. Like 9 of 12 are still playing. So like when we talk about like, you know, relevancy, and when we talk about analytics and where Florida ranks and how we thought people were overreacting a little bit, I do think it is absolutely crazy. Like even as me, someone who believes in the advanced analytics and numbers, these KenPom numbers of almost every other team. And I should also point out, just so people know, the team that was in fourth that is not in the Sweet 16 is Auburn. Kind of thought they were a little bit fraudulent. But yeah, 13 of KenPom's top 14 teams are still playing. Then it was 17 and 23. And then there's one team that's an outlier, and it's NC State, who's 54th. So yeah, like when we were saying that Florida didn't look like they were a second weekend team, even though we thought they maybe would win one, like, yeah, everything showed that. And I think that should kind of help frame the season that, again, and you, that's something for you and the fans and media and the athletic department to decide, like, what do we see Florida as a program? But like, I don't know, a lot of people saw this as some really successful season, and it's like, well, right, they were somewhere between 25 and 30th, really. So, you know, whatever your personal standards are, I guess that's, you know, that's what you think, but, The metric that has nailed this tournament pretty well said Florida was what they were and lost when they should have. So yeah, I thought that was fairly interesting to see, and you know, well, does that happen every year? No. So this is a 1 year sample to nail it entirely. But if you go back at preseason AP polls, if you look back at preseason KenPom polls, if you look at KenPom going into the tournament, these things are would surprise you how accurate they are, because there's such a narrative of like, oh, you know, once the ball's tipped in March, anything can happen, or when it comes to people, oh, like these guys are clowns, like they don't know what they're talking about, like you know, that's they're more right than you think, as much as it's painful to admit, because there's certainly some AP voters that are not very good. So just, you know, think about that next year when we see what Florida's Florida's ranked what things happen. But more overarching takes for sure that point to this, like, I think Florida had their season end where it should. And then the other thing I would just say, because I know a lot of people talked matchups and like, oh, they ran into a team that had a big man at center and was pretty talented, and oh, if they had a different matchup, and like, yes, matchups like matter to an extent, but it's also like even when you were like, oh, I mean, like, I guess like maybe that Kerry Blackshear team, if they had the right matchup, would go far. Like, that's like, if we're talking, you need matchups to justify moving forward, you're probably not a very good team. Like, cause that's like, that's all you're saying is like, oh, if you caught every break, then you could go on a run. Like, that means you're not very good. Like, so that's how I feel about that Kerry Blackshear team. And that's a little bit like, I saw a lot of like, oh, if Florida matched up with a different team, if Florida had a different 10 seed, oh, maybe it would have, like, and yeah, that's obviously true. Matchups matter greatly in basketball, but it's also like, okay, if you're, you know, struggling with this team that hasn't beaten the top whatever 35 KenPom team all year, and you just become their best win, that's just probably not a situation where you can logically argue that you got done dirty in terms of matchups, or you needed a better matchup, or this was a bad one. And then I don't know if you have anything to say on the KenPom stuff, but I'll also say another overarching take was that Florida built a team to play two bigs and stuck to it, really. Like, they really didn't have an option to do much else, but they built a team that was a two big team, but they couldn't handle big men. Like, they played big without being able to handle physicality. And I think that's something that it's going to be interesting to see how they build their roster this year. But like, Eddie Lampkin is not an all, I don't think he's an, I was going to say he's not an All-American, certainly not an All-American. I don't really think he's a, I don't know if he was, I was, and I don't know if he's an all Pac-12 player. Maybe he was, I don't think he is, to my eye. And, you know, let him, like, Quinnipiac bigs and mid-major bigs all year long and bottom half of the SEC bigs. They had their way with Florida. And if you're going to build your team on playing two bigs, you probably don't want to be bullied by bottom half bigs in whatever league you're playing in. So that was kind of my other takeaway. But maybe that's even more of like a future portal discussion. But even just the way Florida built their roster this year, I think they're going to have a lot of they're going to be reconsidering a lot of things.
Yeah, no. So I think some of the big men thing might have been sort of the youthful big men struggling with bigger, you know, bigs and that type of physicality. I'm not saying it got tremendously better during the year. I didn't really have Eddie Lampkin having 21 points and 5 assists in the NCAA tournament against Florida on my bingo card.
And maybe we should, based on how the year went.
But maybe we should have, exactly, yeah, based on how the year went. Yeah, and I would add on the Torvik thing, just Chad Bigger-Mazzulla got kicked out of the game in like 2 minutes against Yale, or you probably have Auburn through as well, in my view, especially the way that they had been playing late in the year where they finally looked like they weren't a fraud, largely because Chad Bigger-Mazzulla made them so good defensively. And like, credit Yale, man. They just attacked his replacement for 38 minutes. I mean, it was amazing, you know, but anyway, so he gets booted into, and Torvik had Florida 21st overall, and 13 of the top 16 in Torvik are in the Sweet 16. So it's not just KenPom, it's other metrics. And then NC State is on this like Kimba Walker-ish heater right now that either will or won't end in the next 4 days. We will see.
What did Torvik have Colorado?
22nd.
Oh, interesting.
So, I mean, it was, you know, and I have heard, including from staff members, man, I can't believe we have to play a top 25 KenPom team in the first round when we're a 7 seed. Like, I'm empathetic to that. I thought Florida, I won't even say I thought. Metrics, let's stick with analytics. Metrics like the Torvik resume profile, they kind of profiled Florida's resume higher, strength of record, profiled Florida's seed higher. But KenPom didn't, right? KenPom had him right there in that 7. Torvik had him in a 6, but still, you know, the point is these things happen. Like, you got to win your first round game. And one good way to lose it is to not get a stop for 11 minutes and let the other team score on 18 consecutive possessions, whether it's a basket or at the free throw line, which is what happened to Florida in the NCAA tournament. And then down 94-81, I thought Florida finally made one adjustment on defense, which was to throw in a press because they didn't have any other choice. It worked pretty well. Colorado turned the ball over a couple times because nobody but KJ Simpson is terribly reliable. Florida sped him up a little bit. And then Walter Clayton went on just one of the more absurd heaters I've seen in the NCAA tournament in many, many years, and showed you why, you know, I would fully expect him to get feedback here from the NBA. And you know, whether he's back or not, we'll see. I think he will be, but he showed you how good he is offensively as a scorer, right? And Florida got it tied to 100 and then lost. But yeah, I mean, really wild second half. We could talk about the officials. Everybody knows they were bad, though. Like, what is there to say? They were terrible. There were more. It wasn't even just the KJ Simpson call. Like, that call at the end of the game was a fairly clear offensive foul. I don't need to defend that take. There are objective, neutral observers who tweet about referees who said that that was a foul. There's a reason that Eric Curry wasn't advanced. He walked halfway across the court to call a technical. And I didn't even think that those were two of the worst decisions in the game. Like, the Condon fifth foul was beyond bad. They called a continuation on a Cody Williams drive where the foul was on the floor and he took 3 steps after they blew the whistle and scored. I mean, there were so many bad calls, most of which went against the Gators. But, you know, one way to negate all that is to, like, get stops for 18 minutes. And I saw some people tweet, and they're like, well, is it hard to get stops when the referees are calling everything a foul? And it's like, no, you just have to keep guarding. Like you can't worry about that stuff. And if it's human nature to worry about that, that's great. But to me, like, there's a reason that Colorado is putting themselves in position to have the refs blow the whistle all the time. And it's really because Florida had a very vanilla scheme that they did not make any adjustments to until they got down 13 with 5 minutes to go.
Yeah, the big one did not go Florida's way, obviously, that call. And I know that to a lot of people that decides the game, and you can kind of argue that, like, in tournament games that are largely one possession, those calls are massive. And obviously when it's essentially a shot at, you know, not quite at the buzzer, but essentially at the buzzer. That was a big one, but it's also, yeah, Florida put themselves in a huge hole with their own play. And it's obviously impossible to know where, to know how these games would have been, you know, if you replay this game exactly with different officiating, you don't know what happens. That was a rough one. And I think maybe the biggest, like, really, I know you mentioned the people that are, you know, neutral observers that watch the games, talking about how bad the officiating was. I think that maybe the maybe even biggest indication is just the fact that none of those refs moved forward to ref the next game. So, right. So I think that tells you something. I do have actually one PSA, just because I heard so many people. I saw people tweeting this. I saw people tweeting at you. People at the Gator Country boards were all over this. So I just wanted just a public PSA to people. And it also actually gives a little bit of a backstory. So if people remember in the press conference, Todd Golden pointed out that Eric Curry, the official, had given him, I forget what he said. He said like three technicals and two of them bid from Eric Curry or whatever. So backstory to that is that Eric Curry is largely based on the West Coast. So he actually officiated a lot of San Francisco games back when he was, when Golden was there. So when he's like, oh, Curry's given me like two, like, I don't think it was this year, the other one. I think it was, and then you can correct me if you know anything different, but I'm guessing that history goes back to previous years, to maybe when he was not even in Florida. But for sure, Curry reffed Golden games several times at San Francisco. So, but here's my real PSA, just because, again, I see people tweeting about this. I see people tweeting at you. Gator Country forums are all about it. And this is just a football mindset, I'll say, is whenever there's bad officiating, people say, oh, what conference are the refs from? Because they think it's like the college football playoff, where it's like, here's the Pac-12 crew and the whatever. So just a PSA, because I know that, like, not many people know this, but, like, refs are all independent contractors. Many of them work upwards of 90 games a year. And literally, like, many will ref six games in 7 days. There's some refs who work like 21 straight days. And that is a whole nother conversation of why officiating in the sport is bad. Some of these officials, especially in non-conference play, like there was an official that I believe tipped or refed a game that tipped off at 2 o'clock in Miami, and then tipped and then did an 11 a.m. the next day in Florida. And you'd have to, like, literally get creative of how he even got flights to make that happen in time. So these refs are way overworked. But they're independent contractors who are happy to play to ref as many games as possible in order to make as much money as possible. So Eric Curry is the perfect example. So, like, Golden calls him out. So a lot of people are like, oh, what conference is he from? That was what people said. So, like, if you just look at what he's refed, like, he is refed in the Pac-12 this year, the Big Ten, the Mountain West, the Horizon League, the Western Athletic Conference, the Big Sky, the Summit League, and the WCC. In addition to, you know, 40 games in non-conference play. Bert Smith was another official on this game. He reffed in the ACC, CAA, the Big East, the Big Ten, the Big 12, the Atlantic 10, the West Coast Conference, the American Athletic Conference, and the Missouri Valley, touching. So he reffed, like, literally, like, nearly every corner of the country. And Owen Short, who is also on the game, has officiated in the SEC, American Athletic Conference, the Sun Belt, the Big 12, the Big 10, the Big 12, or sorry, I said that twice, and the Summit League. So just so people know, like, I just think this is a good opportunity, because I know a lot of people are probably thinking, oh, where's this ref from? Was he a Pac-12 ref? Was he an SEC ref? Like, and some refs do work only the same leagues. And again, these refs do, like, generally live somewhere. So a lot of them have bookers that they like, or if they'll say, hey, I'll ref this many games and then I'll get on the Big Ten tournament. I think Teddy Valentine famously was barred from the Big Ten tournament or Big Ten play. Recent. So it's not to say that there's not, like, some level, like, it's not completely random, But as you can tell, like, these refs that were not very good, or at least I say that as a crew, it seems like even the neutral observers really said it was only one of the guys out of the three. So I feel bad for lumping them all in. But yeah, these guys have all reffed in like half of the leagues in the country just this year. So just a little PSA to people who were maybe wondering that, or maybe heard people say that angrily in group chats, like, oh, was this a Pac-12 crew? It's like, no, not really. Like, yeah, like Curry's largely a West Coast guy, but he's certainly not a Pac-12 official. Because, yeah, that's just not really how it works. So, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I would add that so Owen Short and Eric Curry were both not advanced and not in the Sweet 16 pool. So they were both basically sent home from Indianapolis, and that's that. Burt Smith was also going to be sent home. And I reached out to one of these neutral observers who knows these things because they get these – correspondences from the NCAA and the officials associations. And so Jason Baker is another official who was in Indianapolis. He got sick. And so Burt Smith ended up refereeing the Purdue game in the second round, Purdue, Utah State. So Burt Smith is the guy who missed the call on Simpson on the baseline. So he actually did officiate in the second round, but was not supposed to. He had been slated to officiate that game and then was replaced by Jason Baker. But then Baker got sick on Saturday. And so they put Smith back in for Sunday. But Short and Curry were dismissed. And they were two of five or six referees that were supposed to be sent home after egregious errors in the first round, because the crew that did the Kansas Samford game was also sent the door. It sent to the door, as they should have been. If anyone stayed up late and watched that game. But I think what was interesting is that this game, I think, you know, both those games kind of got a lot of chatter because of what happened at the end of them. But the problem, they aren't sent home for missing one call. It's really a consistent number of calls and plays. And in the Samford Kansas game, it seemed like every big call went in favor of Kansas. And in the Florida-Colorado game, with the exception of one like tipped ball pass in the first half, it seemed like every bad call kind of went against Florida. And that usually is how, a crew is dismissed or sent home from the NCAA tournament, which means a lot of money to them.
Yes.
You know, and that's the other thing I want to point out is it is a significant punishment because – you know, you get $1,500 a game in the first round, $1,500 a game in the second round, and then it goes up from there. So this is a chance for them to make quite a bit of money that they don't make necessarily in the regular season, not as much.
Yeah, and they get rather large per diems and travel costs and accommodations that are like kind of open secret. Correct. Like I believe they get travel based on like first class. So like most of the guys don't and get the difference, and they get a certain allotment for accommodations, and that would be quite a high level, and most guys just get a regular room. And so even that dollar figure is I would venture to guess that the real value of that is much larger, in addition to that's like people do know this. So like when they're trying to book games for next year, you know, this is something on their resume, quote unquote. So yeah, like I know a lot of people kind of wish that there was like post-game scrums that these guys would have to answer questions. And that's kind of the accountability that people are looking for. And yeah, I can understand looking for blood, but I don't think people do realize that, like, and I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure like even in like SEC play, for example, I'm pretty sure every game is even like every single game is reviewed for officials.
Correct.
So like even if you're playing a nothing game against Missouri on a Wednesday night when the season's functionally over, like these refs are still like they're trying to get their next assignment. They're trying to. And again, if you're someone like I mentioned, some of these guys that were just in conference play had been doing some Summit League games or WAC games and stuff like that, like. Yeah, like they'd rather be doing SEC games. Like that's no, you know, there's no secret. So like these guys are constantly getting reviewed in a way that I don't think people realize. And there is constant room for advancement to better leagues and more money because of it. Or for lack of a better term, demotions, like which in this case is more just like the SEC stops hiring you and the big power conferences stop hiring you. So again, like, yeah, I do think there's more repercussions than people think, arguably a lot more. But yeah, I also know people just want blood when they'd rather have a guy have to go face questions and then say someone tell them they're never coaching basketball or officiating basketball ever again, which is certainly, you know, not going to happen. But yeah, hopefully if you are someone who is just seething mad, you at least know that there is some negative repercussions to this game that, yeah, was not particularly well officiated by. Now I think we can say, whether it be neutral observers or the fact they didn't advance, we can say, objectively, was not a well officiated game.
Yeah, and I will add that Bert Smith had been on the short list for the Final Four, according to one of the observers that I spoke to, and has been removed from that list also. So, yet another consequence to him, even though he advanced to the second round due to an illness of another referee, Bert Smith won't be at the Final Four, and he is, you know, supposed to be one of the better officials in the country, but he missed a call. You know, I thought Todd was right to say, hey, man, I don't know how you go from getting D'd up to 7 feet of separation. It was kind of a really good point. It's a clear offensive foul, and it was called one in the Michigan State North Carolina games a couple times, like almost the same exact drive with Tyson Walker on Cormac Ryan. Ended up going the other way, and that made that a little hard to watch on Saturday. But yeah, anyway, you know, so I think a lot of things kind of go into that, but at the same time, you know, I don't want to say if you get some stops, it doesn't matter. Of course, the officiating matters. And I'm very careful the way I talk about it. But I think the bigger picture point at this time is really that, like, Florida kind of was who we thought they were. Like, even if they win the Colorado game, we saw Colorado play Marquette and lose because Tyler Colec was healthy. It was close. I think Florida Marquette would have been close. I mean, the Gators – one thing about the Gators is, with the exception of what Tennessee – and Ole Miss, they didn't get blown out. They played a ton of close games. The Auburn game, but you can, I mean, fourth game in 4 days, handlocked, and I don't really, you know. But you know what I mean? Like, they didn't get blown out, but then I got that text from that Marquette beat writer, my buddy Ben, and I was like, well, Florida's not, they don't beat anybody by 15. Because he's like, oh, you'd beat Marquette by 15. And I was like, well, Florida didn't beat anyone by 15. Like, when they beat Alabama by 14 in the SEC tournament, it was honestly kind of surprising, because that really wasn't – like, Florida's MO was to beat anyone by, you know, 5 to 10. Like, that was a convincing win for the Gators, because they weren't good enough defensively to separate themselves from teams. And teams would get behind, and then they would press, or they'd switch to zone or something. And so Florida's offense – you know, you could count on Florida's offense to at least have a few minutes a game where they weren't terribly consistent either. So they weren't a team that was going to pound you by 20. You know, not that there's a ton of those teams out there. I mean, even if you look at the NCAA tournament now, you know, there's 7 to 10 teams that can beat you by 20 that are still playing. 10 might be a stretch. But that was just kind of my point, is that Florida was kind of programmed to play close games. So even if they had one, you know, I don't think they were going past tonight or tomorrow night. I will stick to that take. And now they have work to do, right? They've got to replace Zion Pullen. And I think they've got to find a really quality replacement for Tyrese Samuel. And I would start there and not with Riley Kugel, who's hit the portal, Eric.
Yeah, just one last thing on Florida's tournament game.
Sure.
Like, if Florida wins that game, that Walter Clayton 2 minutes is like
immortal.
Like, that was absolutely insane. And yeah, that's almost one of those, like, I mean, it's not quite at the level of, like, what's his name on you'll remember, on North Carolina, who hit that shot the possession before the Villanova winner from Chris Jenkins, with that, like, double pump three. And it was like it would have been like, if that held as the winner, it would have been like an incredible shot. And then Chris Jenkins hits one on the other end, and now I don't even remember his name who hit it. So I'm not saying it's like quite at that level, but like, unfortunately, outside of Florida fans, I don't think anyone really, like, even fully realized that insane Walter Clayton 2 minutes, where he was invincible. And yeah, it's just something that I hope that people do remember in a couple of years or whatever. Hey, do you remember that time?
Marcus Page.
There you go. Thank you. Which tells you something. I forget who it was, but I remember who Chris Jenkins. Remember Chris Jenkins shot right after. Actually, and I can picture the Marcus Page shot. I just blanked on his name, and he was obviously a very good player, so I should remember that. But yeah, and that just kind of also shows you how fickle things are. Like, yeah, you could also say, well, that's the counter to one bad call going Florida's way. It's also like, well, it took somewhat of a miracle of one player going on an all-time heater to put Florida in that position. But yeah, just want to make sure that, like, let's put it out there. Let's not forget that
yeah, from Walter. That's a great point. And I did appreciate, okay. So first of all, I want to say one other thing. I loved having Harlan and Bonner and Van Gundy on the call, 'cause they're just so good. Mm. And I loved after Clayton made the three, Van Gundy going, is Reggie Miller in the building? Because it was in Indianapolis.
Yeah. I thought Van Gundy was awesome. I think that some college people were like just real college basketball fans, maybe didn't like it. And but it just like his pure disgust too at some of like the coaching decisions throughout the weekend and like some of these players like Rafferty's kind of getting the same way where he's just like, what are you? Like at the end of the Florida Atlantic game,
yeah,
where they did not get a very good shot on the last possession. He was just like, yeah, he was just despondent. He was so mad, but it is portal time. Did you say you wanted, you thought it started with the Tyree Samuel?
So I think it starts with Tyree Samuel and Zion Pullen because I love Riley Kugel more than most Florida basketball observers, you know, and I think it's because I'm in love with his talent. But for me, like replacement player, you have to start with ZP and Samuel.
Yeah. And I would say like Samuel's a better player than Pullen is a better player than Samuel. But Samuel is like, while it's not necessarily replacing him, like I said, this was a team that was built on a front court that's very different than how other teams play, and it wasn't good enough. So I'm not saying that you necessarily need to get better at that particular position. Like, to be honest, again, we talked about Florida and the NCAA tournament being exactly what they were. I mean, Tyree Samuel this year was exactly what we knew he was. And that's because, again, when he plays in a high major league, you just – no, and he's played 4 years, you know what he is, and you knew that he could score in the block. But like, it was one of those things that like, was he abused in space all year long? And in that Colorado game, yeah, he had some awful moments, but I don't blame him. He is a center. Like, again, and I know positional arguments are stupid. I hate engaging with them, but you know, I said he was a center. People are like, well, he's actually a power forward. Okay, well, anytime he was on the floor and some other four put the ball on the floor against him, they got to the rim untouched. And we saw that in Colorado's game. I don't blame Tyree Samuel for that. He was put in that position. So I say that not to just like, I truly don't see that as a negative towards, like, if you go say, hey, Micah Hanlock didn't go run pick and roll next year and he looks bad doing it. Whose fault is that? So that's just one of those things where like, and then even too, there was a lot of like, oh, well, we think we can get Tyree Samuel to shoot. Well, there's nothing over the last 4 years to really suggest that. Did Tyree Samuel shoot this year? No. So again, and I don't blame him for that. He is exactly what he is. And when you bring in a player who's played 4 years in a high major league, like, you know exactly what you're getting. And if you expect anything different, that's on you. So I'll be really interested to see generally how Florida attacks the front court with Tyree Samuel. Like, I think Pullen's the most important player, but needing to replace a starting point guard, pretty universal. You know what you need to do there. But in the front court, like, in the Gators might have two spots to fill because we don't know what Micah Hanlockton's timeline is going
to
be.
I think it's actually safe to assume it will be two
spots. That's what I would think. I'm going to be very interested to see how they attack that position particularly. Are they going to go at a more prototypical four that can actually guard that position because they didn't put their guys in position? Like, and again, that is not a negative towards Tyree Samuel. People who have watched him play a million minutes of college basketball should have known what he can and cannot do. And he was put in a position to do something he couldn't defensively. So I'll be really interested to see what they do there. And then at the center position, What they do as well, do they go at somewhat more of a defensive anchor who has maybe a little bit less offensive upside, but helps the defense? Or do they try to get someone again who can be a little bit more of someone they can throw the ball into? Because I do think they enjoyed the being able to throw it into Samuel at times. They even saw they gave it to Condon, I think, even a little bit more than I thought they should have. And I like Condon, and he's got some post-up ability, but they went to him a lot. And I do just wonder, oh, do they go at a more versatile four who's maybe a little bit smaller, can't bully as much, but can guard and hopefully shoot a little bit more? And then in the center position, do you get like a, I'll say, Alabama of recent years, kind of not an offensive upside guy, but someone who could block shots and rebound the ball and play defense? Because that would be a situation where I'm not saying that's exclusively where Florida's defensive problems lied, but I think a whole lot of them was that the fact that they couldn't guard the four at the perimeter, or they couldn't guard pick and rolls because their fives were not very good at guarding pick and rolls, and no one really provided rim. And no one provided any rim protection outside of Alex Condon, who the Gators are really happy will be back. So, that is why I do find, I'll say, Tyree Samuel, but really, I mean, overall front court. That to me is the most interesting part of Florida's transfer portal. That, even though you could certainly make arguments for like, hey, they didn't have wings, they need wings. Hey, the point guard's extremely important, they need to replace. That's why, like, you can make those arguments. But I think that how the team played this year was really defined by their front court, how they chose to build it. So I kind of feel like how they're going to play next year is going to be really defined by how they build the front court.
Yeah, no, I think that's very true. And I think when you look at, and again, I think the other thing to kind of factor into that is that, you know, what do they really expect from Thomas Houck next season? Like, what's their vision for Thomas Houck? I don't think we necessarily know that. And like, I think complementing whatever their vision is for Houck is more evidence that the front court bid piece of the build is probably the most critical. And then you could add in the Denzel Aberdeen development. Like, I didn't have Stan Van Gundy gushing about Denzel Aberdeen's defense and just his improvement when he like watched a handful of Florida film at the beginning of the year and the end, and Stan Van Gundy was like, whoa, like there's a guy who I think has gotten a lot better. Anyway, like, what's his role? So I think obviously Florida probably expects a nice leap from Denzel. They expect Walter Clinton to be back. I expect Walter Clinton to be back. And I think with Kugel gone, you also have some NIL money freed up that you probably would have been investing in Kugel that you can kick to Clayton. So I wouldn't anticipate Florida losing their star guard. And that, to me, whenever you have a star in one position and, you know, a lot of question marks at another position, even with a guy who could become a star in Alex Condon, yeah, the front court build seems to be the focus. But I don't want to discount, you know, replacing Zion Pullen, because we've seen with Kyle Lofton, the seeing eye single, as Eric so aptly described on the last show, that it can appear that you hit on a point guard, and then that is not the case as soon as they get to this, to the next level. And look, the SEC was good this year, but not a great league. And I don't always use the NCAA. I really don't. And in fact, you can go back and listen to podcasts and, you know, if Eric doesn't recall it, I know that I have made this take before, but I don't think the NCAA tournament is the best representation of what a conference is. But I also think the SEC like lacked elite teams. Like, I thought it was a good league that lacked elite teams and had a lot of teams that were kind of pretty similar to Florida. And that's how a team like South Carolina was in position for a double bye until the very last game of the year, right? Because there wasn't just far and away teams that were better. And, you know, if you want me to throw in a little hot take on it, I think North Carolina will handle Alabama tonight because they're just better than them, right? They get stops, they can score with them. If you try to run with North Carolina, North Carolina says thank you. So, you know, there's a lot of reasons that I'd be stunned if Alabama went to the Elite Eight. But, you know, and I'm not using this to digress. I'm just saying that, like, Florida is going to need a guy who can play in a very good league. Whether they need a guy who can play in a great league is sort of another question. But you still got to have somebody that can make that jump, because – the one thing the SEC should have next year is really good guards again.
Yeah, it's and again, it's just like I think everyone just like universally knows what kind of guard Florida needs. Like they need someone who can take care of the ball because some other guys have turnover issues. They know that they still need some offensive juice. So because Design Pullen had a lot of it. But then it is also one of those things that's like, say Florida got like a higher usage post player or a higher usage like power forward again. Then suddenly you could say, oh, do they go after more of like someone more of a like responsible spot up shooter kind of guy who's maybe not as much a paint touch downhill kind of guard. And that would kind of inform that decision. Or if they get like big time shot blocker, rim protector, can guard pick and roll center, and like a 6'9", 210 pounds, so he can guard on the perimeter and hit 35% of his threes for, then it's like, oh, then you could, then maybe do you go after like one of these like 6-foot mid-major guards who score 20 points a game in a low major league and can come in and like provide some juice and run around and create something out of nothing. So that again is why I'm like very interested about the front court build. And again, I just like, that's the other thing too about Florida's offense that did look a little choppy this year to me, was just the fact that like Zion Pullen's best with the ball, Tari Samuel's best with the ball. And I actually thought Walter Clayton was really good off the ball and almost best off the ball. So I actually think he turned out to be kind of a perfect, like, I think Clayton's going to be kind of perfect in whatever setting you put him in. But Florida didn't have enough guys that were like that. Like Clayton was good without the ball. Like Tari Samuel, it was not. Micah Hanlockton was not. You know, not to put these guys down because they're young, but you know, like Alex Gonin, you know, Thomas Hawk, not yet. Hauk obviously showed the some spot up shooting ability, which would be awesome and would be a great way to get him into the game more. And Connin's really good, but he's someone who's also best posting up. He was not like sit in the dunker spot and catch lob. So I that's why I think that Florida's offense was a little bit disjointed, is because, you know, I talked enough about the X's and O's, but even again, when the ball started kind of popping, they didn't have enough guys that are outside of Clayton, who was tremendous playing off the catch and making things happen. So again, just having pieces that fit a little bit better offensively, I think would be a way to go. But if you get like a super high usage person that you're going to play at the four, like Tari Samuel, yeah, I don't know. I just wonder if like they go the more like, okay, we're going to go after a big time usage guard, like as I'm pulling again. So yeah, actually at the four, we just need a spot up shooter, not someone who's like a mid post ISO guy, like what we played Samuel as. And oh, at the center, we need someone who actually has some like ability to catch off cuts and finish lobs around the rim and has some better hands. So then, you know, we can just get a guy who's going to score 7 or 8 points a game, and they're all going to be off offensive rebounds and lobs, like just for a little bit more of a prototypical kind of like, you know. And then you, if you can have point guard who can score and facilitate, you've got Clayton who can really score off reversals and shoot it and do some ball handling when needed. Then if you have like Will Richard, we'll see if they try to get something else at the three, but I'll say Will Richard for now. Catch and shoot guy, get another catch and shoot that guy at the four, get a hard screen setter and lob catcher at the five. Then that suddenly makes a lot of sense, where this year it was like nothing at the five, a post up four who doesn't shoot. Will Richard, who is, you know, great catch and shoot guy. And then Walter Clayton, and then, you know, another high user. So I don't know. It just didn't feel like they got the most, like the sum of Florida's, like the sum of Florida was worse than its parts offensively. And again, I think it just starts with some of the front court decisions. So yeah, I don't know. That's why I'm just so intrigued by how they go about the front court specifically.
Yeah. We've already even seen a couple names, and like, I had a sigh of relief when I saw some people talking about Lynn Kidd from Virginia Tech. And I was thinking like, what doesn't fit with what they probably need and want to do. And I mean, we saw Lynn Kidd commit to Miami, and I was kind of like, well, I was kind of just glad that it wasn't somebody that Florida was terribly interested in pursuing, even if he has ties to Gainesville. Cause you know, I think Todd does want to play with two bigs. I think they want to attack the offensive glass. It's pretty clear that's kind of what he hopes the identity to be. But you know, the other piece is the one Eric alluded to at the top of the show, right? Like, you have got to guard opposing front court players better. So like, what do you look for in the portal that helps you accomplish that, because, you know, even if Walter Kuyt is magnificent and they do okay at the point guard spot, they're going to have to get stops at a more consistent rate if they want to achieve some of the things that I think you can do at the University of Florida in basketball.
Yeah. And I almost wonder if it's even easier to just get a four who can guard and be an appropriate average 3-point shooter. Like, Florida paid a whole lot of money to get Tari Samuel, and Tari Samuel was, again, exactly what he was. And that was really, really good. I just don't even know if that was the best fit for what Florida needed. But he was definitely good, and they paid a lot of money for it. So I just wonder, like, you'd spend a little bit less there and get someone who's got a little bit more of a focused skill set. And then again, at the five, like, it would be great to have someone who can shoot and dribble and guard and rebound and be physical, but also quite like, and check every box. I mean, NBA player. But really, like, you do see like Alabama had a lot of success with these, just like guys that didn't necessarily shoot, never dribbled the ball, but they could catch lobs. They could roll hard. They had good hands, and they could guard. So, and I feel like those are going to be maybe easier guys to get than like, oh, we want to get a stretch five who's also got SEC size. Like, that's going to be hard to get if that's what you're trying to do. So, and again, it's also just going to come down to, yeah, where does Florida want to invest for lack of better, well, not even lack of better term, it's straight up. Where do they want to invest? Do they want it to be in the front court? Do they want to try to get a legitimate wing, which is going to be very hard to do because there's so few of them. As we know, point guard's an interesting one because point guard is so, the point guard position is both important, but there's also a good amount of them. So that's going to be really interesting too, because there's a lot of teams last year that not Florida teams that spent a whole lot of money very early in the cycle to get point guards that were not as good as their market value, because teams were like, oh my goodness, point guard is so important. We need to get this done. There's a solid guy in the portal. Let's go outbid everyone and get him right now. And that happened. And a lot of teams were not happy with their point guard play, where the Gators were patient. They waited. Maybe they had something in the works earlier. We don't know, but it obviously worked out very, very well with Zion Pullen, who, you know, couldn't have asked for much more. So that just is also a place where, like, will the Gators be patient again with point guard? Will they go after someone, you know, early? We'll still see the biggest stretch of good names come after the NCAA tournament. But it's really become like, just like how the NBA is a 12-month year sport, often with drama, but mostly even two, just because everyone loves the player acquisition point of it. Like, this is way more interesting than when we were talking about high school recruiting like 5 years ago on the podcast. That is for sure.
Yeah, it does make for better podcasting, and I think more consistent Patreoning too, which would be something I would give you guys a shout towards. Patreon.com/FloridaBBHour. Make sure you check out all the stuff we got going on there. We'll have some portal updates up today, and then some Sweet 16 thoughts from me that are also going up today. So a couple of different things hitting your inbox as we get ready for more basketball. You know, really fun weekend if you're a huge fan of the sport. If you're listening to us 58 minutes in the show, you probably are, Eric.
Yeah, I think so. It's the greatest thing about March Madness is that there's never a bad NCAA tournament. Like, stories will always come. Shout out to the Patreon where, I forget who asked the question. One of our longtime subscribers for sure, though, asked who we thought was most likely 14 seed or lower to get a win. What did I say? I said Oakland. Oakland went and got the win. So that's the kind of Patreon content that you're getting is questions such as, what is the 14 seed or lower that's most likely to win? And I had Oakland. There'll be plenty of stuff up on that too. And, shortly. And yeah, this is even a great week or a great weekend. Like, I know the first weekend is king, but as someone who like I have to watch every single second of each play, and that's not like I have five screens going. I have one screen going and I am pausing and two commercials going to other games. Like, I need to watch every second on one screen, and I know I'm a psychopath for that, but it's a little exhausting. So now that there's a fewer games, you can really lock in. I still do like the first weekend of the NCAA tournament the most, but I will say there are times where things are a little bit more spread out. You can, it's a little easier to like really lock in that. I'm like, oh man, maybe this is even better, but whatever it is, these are two incredible weekends of sports watching.
Totally, man. It's the best. It is the best. And yeah. So I guess last topic, Riley Kugel obviously hits the portal. No surprise there. I think this has been coming for quite some time. I think what was the most surprising was I had heard a lot of chatter about Michigan and Georgetown. And then they didn't even appear on this top four list he tweeted out, which is like blue blood, Arizona, Houston, blue blood, Kansas, UConn. So I was like, whoa. But goes to show like one of those things that Eric and I have talked about over the years, like elite coaches think that they can fix players. So they all see like a potential lottery talent and they're like, yes, come to our school and I will make it right.
Yeah. I'll say that was somewhat surprising, but yeah. You said it. It's something that you talk to every coach. They think they can figure out talent better than the other guy. It is a universal coaching truth. And it goes kind of the other way, or a different way with like the NBA, where the NBA doesn't have much respect for college coaching, to be quite honest. So like, I wouldn't be surprised if there's some NBA teams who still like what they're seeing. Again, we don't need to, you know, kick the guy on his way out the door, but yeah, I still look at some of the, like, I really think you can make a very easy argument that he was the worst finisher in college basketball this year. That's just something that is to plague him for 2 years. I'm curious to see if he can figure that out. But I think he's a good defender, has the potential to be great for sure. So we'll see what happens there. Does the shot just straighten out and become more consistent? It'll be very interesting, because wherever he's going, it's also going to be a place that's going to have a lot of expectations next year. So I will say those are not the teams that I expected to be, to be his final four. That almost looks like it's about to mirror the final four of the literal NCAA tournament. I know it can't actually. If Kansas didn't get injured, if you said a month ago, what do the teams UConn, Arizona, Houston, and Kansas have in common, you would have been like, oh, final four teams, not Riley Kugel's final four. So obviously injuries, you know, kept, and you know, bracketing, but kept it from happening. But that's not what I expected for sure. And hey, he also made a really good NIL check this year. So maybe he was willing to take less to go to a very good, you know, winning program like that. You never know how that stuff works. That is purely my speculation.
Yeah. Hey,
negatively sourced, but again, it's like, hey, he's you wonder what happens, but hey, if these coaches just saw the potential and really bought in, that could be it. But he is going to be one that is like fascinating to see, where things go. And, especially just like, it would have been one thing if he was going to, I don't know, insert like low level, high major or mid plus or whatever. Yeah. That would be one thing. I mean, the fact that he's going to go to an elite program, who's going to be expected to be a Final Four team next year, like any of those four teams are going to think, hey, going into next year, hey, we are a Final Four team. So, maybe Riley Kugel is what they need to push them over the edge. I truly will be fascinated to see. And, I do wish him the best. I think my kind of final thought was I do think his buzz just got too high, and it's not his fault. He played great basketball at a time where no one on Florida was playing good at all. And he stepped up to the plate and played incredibly at the end of last season. And because of it, I think his stock got boosted a little bit high, where expectations were poor. Looking back at pump up my own work, and I think the people who've listened for 6 years know I don't do that very often. To be honest, I don't even think I'm a very good writer, so that's why it doesn't happen. But I think that when you look back and see like that, like, yeah, like again, his numbers last year really mirror what they are this year in a lot of ways. The difference is that Florida was playing competitive games this year. And last year, they were not playing competitive games, and he was doing things in a slightly bigger role in games that the Gators were losing by 15. So I do think that expectation just got a little bit high on him. I don't think he was a fit for the personality of the coaching staff. But yeah, hey, he stepped up and gave his all at a time where not every Florida player was, to be quite honest, at the end of last season. So if anyone does hold any, we wish he did something different here this year, I don't know. I would just remember that he really stepped up at a time that no one else was for the Gators in year one. He did it as a freshman. That's big. And he will make for a very interesting story next year as someone who's probably going to be on all the like breakout candidate lists that like college basketball media does. And it's certainly possible. I could also see a world where he doesn't become like a starter at one of these schools. And we'll see what that does exactly. But hey, it's got to be cool to have a rough season, put your name in the portal, and have the best programs in the country come and watch you.
Yeah, the KenPom rankings are 1, 2, 5, and Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. Yeah, if those are your targets, you ooze talent and potential. And I will say, I love the way he played against Colorado.
Mm.
I mean, you talk about like responding to adversity and like the fact your coaches wouldn't even put you in a game at the SEC tournament for the last 2 days. And you come out against Colorado and have a really good game, 13 points, 3 of 6 from the field, no turnovers, 2 steals, a block, really 2 blocks, but you got called for a foul on a block where you didn't commit a foul. I thought he was excellent, and he kind of was the key to Florida's like press too. Like, to be honest, like his length was a real problem for anyone that wasn't KJ Simpson handling the ball. And so like, I don't know, you know, somebody asked me already what I thought the best fit of those four was. And I was like, well, honestly, I think it's UConn or Arizona just stylistically, but like, it's hard for me to picture him playing in Kelvin Sampson's system. But whatever, like, good for him. So I hope that I wish him well. I got another question that was, is anybody else from Florida less that we didn't suspect going to hit the portal? And I don't think so. I think Florida's, I think that's done. Because what we've reached, I saw a great tweet. I don't know if it was Trilly. It was either Trilly or Doster. And I do think they're different people. But I think it's definitely, that was a joke. Truly, I think it was Doster who said, we've now hit the part of the portal where it's like the guys who really love their schools and or didn't want to break their coach's heart are entering the portal. Mm. And it's like, I think Kugel clearly loved being a Gator. Otherwise, like, honestly, it would have been like portal season, like this, as soon as he walked out of the locker room from the Colorado game. And honestly, I think a lot of Gator fans kind of expected that, and it took a few days. And now we're seeing guys like Jordan Sears and Riley Kugel and these people like hitting the portal, and it's like, oh, you really loved being where you were, didn't you? So I don't know. I liked that tweet, but we'll be back with you for more portal talk. And unless Eric has anything else, I'll let him sign us off.
Nope. There will be portal talk on the Patreon here today, I imagine, or sometime soon. If you really want to jump on that, there'll be some names or today. I guess I don't even know when this podcast is going up, but quickly after this podcast is up, the Patreon will be there. So if you want to jump on portal talk with some of the names of Florida is after, that'll be there. So, enjoy the second weekend of the tournament, and we'll get back at you soon. Go Gators, and keep attacking closeouts.